Welcome to another episode of 40 Minutes in the Old Testament. 40 Minutes in the Old Testament is a 1517 Podcast Network podcast. You can go to 1517.org/podcast, check out all the other podcasts that are living over there. There's a new podcast coming out. The trailer is up. That means you can go ahead and subscribe to it so you don't miss the first episode. That podcast is called Outlaw God with Steve Paulson. So you can check out the trailer. Just search Outlaw God in whatever podcast app or whatever way you listen to podcasts, whatever Spotify or iTunes or whatever, and click on Outlaw God. Subscribe to that. I don't think you're going to want to miss that one. Chad, I'm already subscribed personally to that podcast. Looking forward to June 9th when the first one drops. I listen to a lot of podcasts, but I will definitely find a way to make room for that one.
It's going to be good. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. Paulson rocks.
Yeah, man. Yeah. So, that's one not to miss. You got to at least give it a shot. So, yeah, subscribe to Outlaw God. And here in about a week from when we're recording this, the first episode of that will drop. So, make sure to check that out. Chad, how are things going, man?
Well, yeah, it's good. Yeah. I mean, personally, things are going fine.
Yeah.
I think I mentioned last podcast that my birthday was coming up, which has now passed us. It was a birthday weekend for me. Got a half century under my belt. It was great. Had my family, had a lot of video greetings from friends and phone calls from a lot of other people. So it was a great weekend of celebration. So it was good to do that.
Well, everything else was just spinning into chaos.
Yeah. Reason I laughed is because, well, of course, before we started the podcast, we were talking about everything going on. It's just, yeah, I think that, you know, covering the book of Judges has kind of prepared us for all of the crazy things that are happening out there.
Yeah, man. Know,
just everything under the sun. It's a pretty wild time right now. But, speaking of the book of Judges, man, we are at the end.
Yeah.
We have two chapters to cover. Don't get me wrong. We're not like a few verses from the end. We have chapter 20 and 21, but we are going to finish the book today. If you've stuck with us through this whole thing, you've been on quite a trip.
Yeah. I
mean, we've just about every kind of dark aspect of humanity has been highlighted in one story or another. It's just it's been a wild ride.
Yeah. At least it ends on a real high note.
Yeah, right. Yeah, kidnapping some virgins for the men who are left from the massacred tribe of Benjamin. Yeah, it's a real highlight. Well, I will say this though, seriously, that in many ways, Ruth is sort of the end of Judges. At least they're typically grouped together, because the story of Ruth occurs during the time of the Judges. So that being said, if you kind of count that as the end, we will end on a high note.
Yeah.
We'll get to that next week. So stay tuned for Ruth. That's going to be, I've taught that book in its entirety a couple of times. So I've already done quite a bit of work on that and look forward to going back over the material again. It's just a great story to begin with. And there's just a whole lot of real rich theology there too.
Yeah. Yeah. Great. Well, before then, we got to get through these last two chapters of Judges. So we're at Judges 20, verse 1.
Yeah. So you probably remember, I'm sure you remember if you listened to the last podcast, what the former story was about. This is one of those cases where something big, something small can turn into something which is really, really big. The way this all started, kind of keep this in mind, beginning with chapter 19, the way this whole story started was with a relationship problem. There was a Levite, and as we talked about, whatever happened, there were some issues between him and his concubine. And that spark is what set ablaze, well, a fire that's going to sweep through the entirety of Israel by the time we're done. Started out with just the two of them, and then it involved a whole city, and then it's going to involve a tribe and the rest of the tribes. So something very small is going to grow into something which is very large and very, very destructive. So we've already seen the gang rape and the murder and the dismemberment of the woman that was in chapter 19. And we're going to pick it up here with chapter 20 and see what happens. Now, the way it ended was with people just aghast. They just were speechless at what had happened. So they're going to gather together and make a decision as to how they should proceed. So beginning with verse 1 here, it says that all the sons of Israel, from Dan to Beersheba, including the land of Gilead, came out, and the congregation assembled as one man to the Lord at Mizpah. So this is almost the entirety of the Israelite tribes. We're going to learn in just a minute that there's one tribe that's missing, the tribe of Benjamin, because the place, the city where this happened in Gibeah, belongs to the tribe of Benjamin. But everybody else is gathered together as one man at Mizpah. Now, there's a kind of a bitter irony here, because if you think back over the stories we've covered in the book of Judges, there have been a number of deliverers that God has raised up, everybody from Gideon to Samson to Deborah to Barak, and not one of them, not a single one of them, has been, under their leadership, able to unite all of the tribes into a unity. So never have the tribes come together as one man, as it says in verse 1 and then again in verse 11. But what brings them together? What finally unites them? Well, it's an anonymous Levite who, as we've already heard, is just a terrible human being, and that's going to be confirmed once more in just a minute. So this is Israel. Nothing has been able to unite them, and they have basically just given in to the Canaanite culture and religion around them. And now that all this has happened, they are going to unite. But what they're going to unite around is basically this crusade of self-destruction. So anyway, they assemble, and you have the leaders there, and they take their stand. In verse 2, it says about 400,000 foot soldiers there. And then we're told in verse 3 that the sons of Benjamin, so the tribe of Benjamin, they knew that everyone had assembled, but of course they themselves did not gather with them. And then we have this question posed at the end of verse 3. Tell us, how did this wickedness take place? Now let me read the next 3 or 4 verses. This is going to be the Levite whom we encountered in the previous chapter. It says he's the husband of the woman who was murdered, which is an interesting way to put this. You may remember from last time at the end of the episode that we said it's a little bit ambiguous. It could go either way. Did she die from the abuse that she suffered from the crowd? Or was she still alive after that? And her husband, this Levite, killed her, murdered her before he cut her up. It's unclear. We can't say. It could go either way. But it says who was murdered. So this guy, he stands up. And this is his story. Now listen carefully to the way that he retells the story of what happened, bearing in mind what we know actually happened. He says, I came with my concubine to spend the night at Gibeah, which belongs to Benjamin. But the men of Gibeah rose up against me and surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me. Instead, they ravished my concubine so that she died. And I took hold of my concubine and cut her in pieces and sent her throughout the land of Israel's inheritance, for they have committed a lewd and disgraceful act in Israel. Behold, all you sons of Israel, give your advice and counsel here. Isn't it fascinating, in a twisted sort of way, just how in the retelling of this story, this Levite, whom we already dislike, just makes himself even more dislikable. It's all about him. I mean, in his retelling of what happened, the narration is all about him. They rose up against me. They surrounded the house at night because of me. They intended to kill me. And then, rather than, you notice, of course, what he leaves out. He said, instead, they ravished my concubine so that she died. No mention of the fact that he's the one who shoved her out the door. No mention of the fact that he treated her with just kind of cold calculation. No mention of the fact that he is responsible in any way for what happened. He pushes all of the blame onto the town of Gibeah, and then by implication to the tribe of Benjamin.
Yeah, which of course there's plenty of blame to go on the town of Gibeah. Of course, I mean we're definitely not saying like, hey, it's all this guy's fault. Those guys, you know, are innocent. Obviously, the ultimate blame lies with them. But the issue here is he's making it sound like they were going to kill me, and then they saw my concubine, changed their mind, and decided to go with that. Not that I threw her out the house as a deterrent.
Yeah. That's what really disgusts me about this. I mean, you do see the sinful nature on full display here. Yes, of course, the men who did this or who perpetrated this horrible, horrible crime are sinful and evil and every other word you can think of to describe this terrible act that they performed. Yes, they are guilty of all of that. But as you say, there's plenty of blame to go around. And so this guy is kind of holding himself up as a victim and as someone who's righteous and who just happened to barely escape martyrdom. And instead, they killed his concubine instead. So he is going to disappear from the story at this point. We'll hear absolutely nothing else about this particular Levite. So who knows what happened to him. But we do know what happened as a result of his speech. It says, verse 8, that everybody rose up as one man, saying, no one of us will go to his tent or return to his house. But now this is what we will do to Gibeah. So what they decide in the next couple of verses is they're going to attack. That's obvious. But they divide up the tribes. They take 10% of everyone. And they're going to more or less be the ones who provide all the necessary provisions to those who go to war. So they take 10% of the men and say, okay, basically you're the guys going to be in charge of making sure that when we go to war, and it might be a prolonged affair, they don't know, that they're going to be the ones who supply food for the people. And they're going to, as it says in verse 10, they're going to punish the people of Gibeah for all the disgraceful acts that they've committed in Israel. And then once more in verse 11, it says that all of the men of Israel will gather against the city united as one man.
Yeah, so they basically do like a 10% draft because they do this by lot, right? So they're right. Like, all right, 10% of us are going to go take care of this.
Yeah, 10% of us are going to, well, there's going to be a lot of warriors, but 10% of those are going to be the ones who supply food provisions for the people. Yeah. So they're united. They're going to do this. And then it says, verse 12, that they sent men throughout the entire tribe of Benjamin, saying, what is this wickedness that has taken place among you? Now then, deliver up the men, the worthless fellows in Gibeah. Literally, that's the sons of Belial in Gibeah. I think that we've talked about that before. Belial is a word that over time came to be a synonym for the devil or Satan. At this time, it probably refers to people that, I don't know what we might call them, because Belial has connections with like the underworld. I was trying to think of an English equivalent. I mean, worthless fellows is fine, but, you know, like hellish guys, something like that, something connected with the underworld or death. Anyway, these are worthless guys, hellish men in Gibeah. Deliver them up to us that we may put them to death and remove this wickedness from Israel. But the Benjaminites would not listen to the voice of their brothers, the sons of Israel. No surprise there. So the tribe is going to stick together. In the next couple of verses, we have the description of how many there were. So there's 26,000 men of Benjamin who draw the sword. And then you have the guys who were in Gibeah, 700 men. Then we have this odd description of some of them. Verse 16 says, out of all these people, that is, out of all these people of the tribe of Benjamin, there were 700 choice men who were left-handed. Each one of them could sling a stone at a hair and not miss. This is the same word. If you remember back in the story of Ehud, the one who made the sword and stabbed Eglon in the belly with it, he was described as left-handed. And in that episode, I think I mentioned that it's a little bit, we're not quite sure. It might mean left-handed. It probably means ambidextrous. In fact, in the Greek translation, that is, they use the Greek word for ambidextrous to translate that particular Hebrew word. Either way, they could use their left hand, which was, of course, unusual then as it is now. And not only that, but they were extremely accurate. They could they could sling a stone at a hare and not miss. Of course, at this time, we associate slingshots, you know, with kids in alleys picking up rocks and shooting them at birds, which is what I did when I was a kid.
Yeah.
I had a slingshot and I was pretty accurate, but this is different. This is not your typical kid's slingshot.
Yeah, I had one of those arm rocket slingshots, you know.
Arm rockets, wrist rockets. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, this time slingers were, and of course this is kind of the background of the David and Goliath story too. Slingers at this time were not guys who, you know, just happened to be pretty good with a slingshot. This was a weapon. There were in almost every ancient army. We have documentation of the fact that there were people who used bows, so there were archers, there were spearmen, and there were slingers. And these slingers were extremely accurate, extremely deadly, and an important part of the military force of the nations back then. So these guys were slingers. That was their job. That was their military job. Now, interesting thing here, you probably heard that the word for sin in Greek or Hebrew means to miss the mark. I think most people have heard that at some point. Well, here's a good example of that. When at the very end of verse 16, when it says they could sling a stone at a hare and not miss, the verb that's used there is chata, and chata is the word that in other circumstances, it's translated as sin.
Yeah.
So you're missing something. Something is lacking. You don't hit the mark. That's what, of course, is being communicated here. Quite literally, they would sling a stone and not chata and not miss. And so that gets transferred over theologically to the realm of either doing evil or refraining from doing good. So you don't live up, you don't match the mark that's been set for you by God. So if you've ever wondered, hey, where's a good example of that biblical definition of sin as missing the mark? Well, here it is right here in verse 16. Okay, moving on. We have a description of basically three battles, and we'll go through these rather quickly because there's just not a whole lot of need to focus on the details. What's going to happen is there's going to be two failed attempts for the taking of the city of Benjamin, and then there's going to be the third one is a successful attack on the city. So what happens is they first of all inquire of the Lord who should go up first in this battle against the tribe of Benjamin, and Judah is decided, which makes sense for a couple of reasons. Judah for quite a while now has been the leading tribe of the Israelites, and the concubine was from the city of Bethlehem, which belongs to the tribe of Judah. So it kind of makes sense that the tribe of Judah would be the first to lead the rest of the Israelites in battle. So they go out in verses 19 to 21 as they're at their first attempt to take the city of Gibeah, and they are just beat back. It says that 22,000 men of Israel died. Interestingly, in these first two battles, there's no mention of any loss of life from the tribe of Benjamin. I'm not saying, and I don't think the scriptures are saying, that no one on their side died, but the focus is entirely upon Israelite casualties and not upon any casualties on the tribe from the tribe of Benjamin, which says to me that the guys from the tribe of Benjamin were really, really good soldiers because they are vastly outnumbered at this point.
Yeah,
you know, maybe they had better fortifications, but
yeah, you're talking about 400,000 is what it says for the men of Israel, versus, you know, 26,000 from Benjamin plus 700, you know, Gibeonites guys. They must have a stronghold. Otherwise, you just like roll in there with full. I mean, if it's just a town, you just roll in there with 400,000 and just end it.
Yeah, right.
But
yeah, something else must have been going on. Maybe fortifications. Maybe these guys who were ambidextrous with their slingshots were just mowing down people left and right. Whatever happened, they were definitely holding their ground and winning both these battles. And you can see the drop in morale on part of the Israelites because they go to inquire of the Lord, and they're weeping before the Lord until evening, and they're wanting to find out, you know, for sure, does God want us to draw near for battle against them? So they do this 2 days in a row, and they lose a whole lot of men. Verse 26 picks up with the third battle. It says that everybody came to Bethel, and they wept. So they're lamenting, they're fasting, they're offering burnt offerings and peace offerings. It says that the Ark of the Covenant of God was there in those days. And we have a really, really strange detail added here in verse 28. It says, Phinehas, the son of Eleazar, Aaron's son, stood before the Ark to minister in those days. Now, I haven't mentioned this before because I wanted to save it to this point. It's an odd comment because this happens at the end of the book of Judges. But if it happened when Phinehas, who is the son of Eleazar, who is the son of Aaron, so this is the grandson of Aaron, if this happened when Phinehas was serving as a priest, then chronologically, this happened way early in the period of the Judges. It occurs at the end of the book of Judges, but chronologically, it would have been much earlier in the time of the Judges. And that tells you that the Canaanization that we've talked about that was occurring in Israel, where Israel becomes more and more Canaanite in their ways, happened not after a long period of time, but pretty early on. So that's why this particular historical referent is significant.
Okay, and it's interesting that they put it here, because in a lot of ways, Samson would have been a better ending to the book of Judges. It would have made, narratively, it might have read better if they had stuck this somewhere else.
Yeah. I wonder if they, well, of course, they saved these two stories at the end. The one we covered first with the Levite who was employed by the guy who had the household idols. And then this story, because these are different than the stories of the book of Judges. But yeah, chronologically, it would have fit, you know, well before any of these. And yeah, it would have been kind of nice actually to end with Samson.
Yeah,
but this is the way they decided to.
You could have ended with this sort of the statement and Sam, you know, Samson, you know, killed more in his life, in his death, in his life, death, and it could have been just like a nice little bow on it.
Yeah. Yeah, so not all the biblical books end on positive notes. That is one thing I've noticed. The end of Isaiah, you know, their worm does not die, their fire is not quenched.
Yeah.
So, yeah, sometimes biblical books don't always end in this little positive note. Okay, we'll pick it up with the story. So I'll just summarize what happens from verse 29 through the end of the chapter. So they finally wise up to the fact, after these first two battles have been lost, that they need a different strategy. So they rely on a strategy that we've actually covered before, and this was not unusual in ancient warfare. If you have a city that's difficult to take, then of course there's different ways that you can go about trying to conquer it. You can lay siege. You can use, as they began to do later on, use various catapults to hurl anything from huge spears to stones to things on fire into the city. You could tunnel under it. You could try and go over it with ladders. You've seen all this reenacted in various kinds of movies. But you could also try and lure the men of the city out to a battle, set an ambush, and then cut them off, take their city while most of the warriors are out fighting in the field. We saw that happen in the city of Ai. You remember that right after Jericho was conquered, then I defeated them, and then they set an ambush, and they were able to defeat the city of Ai. They're going to use the same battle plan here. So they set an ambush, and then when the tribe of Benjamin goes out to battle against them, they are initially successful. And so they think, oh, this is going to be just like the first two battles. We're going to win this one as well. And so they're lured farther and farther out away from the city. Well, while the soldiers are lured away from Gibeah, then the guys who were sitting in ambush, they attack the city, they take the city, they set it on fire, and as soon as they set it on fire, that's the signal that the rest of the Israelites are looking for, because when they see that, they've been running from the tribe of Benjamin, from those soldiers. When they see the smoke, they turn back, and when they turn back, then the tribe of Benjamin looks behind them, sees the smoke that's rising from Gibeah, and realizes that they've lost, that there's no hope for them. So they begin to just scatter, and the rest of the chapter describes how they're just chased here, they're chased there, they're just mown down, and it says they couldn't get away from the battle. The verb that's used there is the verb for stick to cleave. It's like the battle stuck to them. There's no way that they could extricate themselves from the conflict. And so more and more of them are taken out in the battle until you have just a few who are left. In fact, when you get to the end of the chapter, it gives us a number. It says there are 600 men. So out of all these tens of thousands of soldiers from the tribe of Benjamin, only 600 are able to escape from the battle, and they flee to, it's called the Rock of Rimmon. Rimmon in Hebrew is the word for pomegranate. Archaeologists think they've figured out where this is at. There's a large cave-like structure that's full of all sorts of other small caves inside it. And supposedly, I looked for an image online. I couldn't find one. But supposedly it has a sort of a look of a pomegranate, thus the name. But anyway, that's probably where most of the commentaries that I've read, they highlight that as this place, this Rock of Rimmon, or this pomegranate rock. That's where they went to. So they were hiding out. 600 guys are all that's left. We're not talking about from the city of Gibeah. We're talking about from the entire tribe of Benjamin. That was it. And it goes on to say that the Israelites just went around destroying all the cities of Benjamin. They just torched every city of Benjamin that they found. They killed women. They killed children. They just wiped out the tribe. So that at least the impression that's given to us is that all that's left of the tribe of Benjamin are these 600 guys who are taking refuge in this pomegranate rock, trying to hold things together and survive the onslaught.
It's a pretty bizarre thing when you have this concubine who was killed. They decide that this is unacceptable, which of course it is. And their solution is, and you know, we've seen how God deals with wickedness within a people. I mean, he'll go and wipe the whole thing out when he decides to deal with it. And it seems like that is somewhat what's happening here, right? Where they're like, we just got to level this whole place. I mean, obviously this place is so corrupt and so wicked because of this thing that we just have to decimate the entire thing. They're not like, well, maybe we can reform it. That is not the motivation here. They're not going to reform it. They're just going to wipe out it's just like not the way that we think of things now. Then they would just assume the evil has spread to everyone. It's the culture of the city is bad and horrible. So we just got to get root it out.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is sort of it's their own version of the harem, right? That we've seen earlier, that kind of sacred decree of complete annihilation or destruction. When you put something under harem, you put it under a ban, basically. So this is what they're doing. Now, the what strikes me most, I guess, about this story, about especially chapter 20, is you have the Israelites. They're finally coming together as a unified force. They're finally doing something about evil. They're finally seeking, even though it's a pretty twisted form of justice, they're trying to engage in that. They're trying to punish the evildoers. So they're doing this, and they're doing this to their own people. They're doing this to their fellow tribesmen. All the while, throughout the book of Judges, what have we seen over and over again? That they don't actually fulfill what God told them to do against the Canaanites, right? They lived among the Canaanites. They intermarried with the Canaanites. They worshiped the Canaanite gods. It's like they were fine with that true evil, with that idolatry. And here, when it comes time for them to actually finally do something decisive and act, then they prove that they're capable of doing that, but they do it against their own kinsmen, all the while really acting like Canaanites in much of the way that they behave. So I guess, you know, that's par for the course with the book of Judges, which is just kind of full of dark comedy and irony. Okay, we have one more chapter to cover, and I think we have about 10 minutes to do that. So let's jump into it. This is this might be the strangest chapter in the book of Judges. I mean, we've had some weird stuff, but this might just be the strangest chapter in the book of Judges, because these guys, okay, they made this vow. That's the way the chapter starts out. They made this, well, the chapter starts out actually with them saying, that in Mizpah, so early on, when they gathered together the first time, when they heard from the Levite, they heard his version of events, we're not told this at that time, but now we're told that they swore an oath. And this oath they swore at Mizpah was that none of us shall give his daughter to Benjamin in marriage. So there was, there was intermarriage back and forth between the various tribes. You know, you have a daughter from the tribe of Dan, and you want to marry her to a guy who's from the tribe of Judah. That's all well and good. There's no problem with that kind of tribal intermarriage. But they swore an oath. It's like, nope, not going to do it with the tribe of Benjamin. So even though they are faithless in so many ways, in so many serious ways in Israel, it's like, well, we're going to have to keep this oath. I mean, to me, that's another one of the ironies here. It's like, no, we got to keep this oath. We're going to break all the other commandments of God, but by God, we swore this oath. We can't break it.
There's some selective righteousness going on here.
There's very selective righteousness going on. And I mean, they're serious about this. They're like going to crazy lengths to make sure they don't break this vow. So what do? Verse 2 says they go to Bethel, and they sat there before God until evening, and they're lifting up their voices, they're weeping bitterly, and they say, "Why, O Lord, God of Israel, has this come about in Israel so that one tribe should be missing today in Israel?" It's kind of an odd question, right? Why did this happen? It's like, were you not paying attention? were you not paying attention to chapter 20? Do you not realize why actually all of this happened? I mean, I know it's a rhetorical question. It's more of a lament kind of why than a why that's actually wanting an answer to the question. I mean, it's kind of one of these, we've all experienced this. We do something, maybe it's violent, maybe it's hateful, maybe it's wrong for some reason. And then afterward, of course, we regret it because we went a lot farther than we intended, or were saddened by the aftermath, whatever it might be. It's like finally after it's all over, the reality comes home and you're like, oh, good grief. What are we going to do now?
Yeah.
What's going to happen now? Well, that's kind of where the Israelites are at. So they get up, they build an altar, they offer offerings to the Lord, and then it's like they come up with a plan. God is silent in all this, which I think is very significant. There's this divine silence, which is deafening. He doesn't tell them what to do. They come up with this kind of this legal, I guess, or at least in their eyes, it's a legal plan on how they're going to be able to solve the issue. So they say, oh, you know what? Who didn't gather with us when we went to fight against the tribe of Benjamin? Was anybody who, any city or people group, that didn't show up? And it says, then it goes on to say they were sorry, one tribe is cut off from Israel today. And what should we do for wives for those who are left? So, I mean, we've sworn to the Lord that we're not going to give any of our daughters in marriage. And so then they ask this question, okay, anybody not come up? And they said, you know what? Yes. Verse 8 says, no one came to the camp from Jabesh Gilead. So here's what they do. They send 12,000 warriors to the city of Jabesh Gilead with these instructions. Go and strike the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead with the edge of the sword, with the women and the little ones. So there's to be this slaughter of the city, because they had sworn an oath that anybody who didn't show up had to be killed. But they had the one exception. Verse 11, this is the thing you shall do. You shall utterly destroy every man and every woman who's lain with a man. And they found among the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead 400 young virgins who had not known a man by lying with him. And they brought them to the camp at Shiloh, that was where the tabernacle was, which is in the land of Canaan. So they go to this city, which didn't take part. We're not told why Jabesh Gilead didn't take part in this campaign against the tribe of Benjamin. But whatever the reason, could have been ignorance, could have been willfulness, whatever happened, they didn't show up. And so they decide, you know what? We can kind of, kill two birds with one stone here, because we can be faithful to our oath to put to death anyone who didn't participate And at the same time, we can find wives for these guys who are hiding out at the pomegranate rock. So they find these 400 virgins in the town of Jabesh-Gilead, and they spare them and they decimate the entire population. And they bring them back to Shiloh. And then it says that they sent some messengers to where the 600 survivors of Benjamin were, saying, "Hey, peace to you." And then they return and they gave them these 400 virgins. There's only one problem, of course. I mean, I'm not very good at math, but I know if you've got 600 guys and you have 400 virgin brides, then you got 200 guys who aren't going to get a wife. So now what are they going to do?
Yeah, this is all horrible ways to keep promises.
Yeah. This is a great example of like living by the letter of the law and just trampling underfoot the spirit of the law.
Yep.
There's no love here. This is nothing more than just, yeah, we've made this vow, and by God, we're going to keep this vow, even if it means wiping out an entire city population and taking these poor virgins who've just seen their families murdered and giving them as wives to these guys that they have absolutely no connection with. So this is the book of Judges, after all. Now, how do we conclude this? Verses 16 through 25 tell of how they're going to get 200 more wives for the remaining members of the tribe of Benjamin. So they ask the question, what are we going to do? I mean, there has to be an inheritance for the survivors. And I mean, we're kind of between a rock and a hard place, right? We can't give our wives to them as daughters because we swore, cursed is he who gives a wife to Benjamin. And then somebody comes up with this plan and says, hey, I know exactly what we can do. Look, every year there's a feast of the Lord in the city of Shiloh, which is on the north side of Bethel. So they get these 200 guys who didn't get the wives, and they say, here's what you can do. Go and lie in wait in the vineyards and just keep your eyes open. And if the daughters of Shiloh come out and they take part in these dances, then you just like rush out of the vineyard, and every guy is going to like grab a woman from the daughters of Shiloh and then run off with her to the land of Benjamin.
Sounds like a great way to start a war.
Yeah, no kidding. Well, I mean, they like come up with their statement ahead of time. It says, well, you know, if their fathers or their brothers, the fathers of these women who were kidnapped, or their brothers, if they come and complain to us, we'll say, you know, more or less, hey, you know, cut them some slack, be gracious to them, because, you know, we didn't find enough wives for these members of the tribe of Benjamin, and we couldn't give our wives to them. So we thought, well, this is a legal loophole that we can use.
They obviously don't think this is something that's so reasonable that these guys would agree with it. So they're going to have to present it as reasonable after the fact.
Yeah. Yeah. This is certainly a case of easier to ask forgiveness and permission. So that's what happens. The guys hid out in the vineyards. And when the girls came out to dance, they took them. And they carried them away, and says they rebuilt the cities and lived in them. And then we wrap up. I mean, how would we finish the book of Judges, right? Let's see, what words could we use that would accurately sum up the entire book of Judges? Well, how about these from the last verse? In those days, there was no king in Israel. Everyone did what was right in his own eyes.
Yeah, that is the theme of Judges. This is what it looks like when people just do what is right in their own eyes. They pull some real. It's like, I mean, this last chapter is like seven brides for seven brothers. If you ever saw that movie back in the day, I grew up watching that movie. It's like that, but like way darker.
Yeah, this is some pretty dark. So, I mean, so we got to get 600 virgins. So here's how we're going to do it. We're going to completely murder an entire population, except for the virgins. And then we're going to set up a place where we can get some girls kidnapped. So murder and kidnapping leads to marriage. I have a feeling that the marriages of these 600 guys were not the happiest of marriages. You know, this is a dark way to end a dark book, but that's just the way that Judges is set up. I mean, it's intended, and this book kind of reminds me, if you're a reader of Flannery O'Connor, any of her novels or her short stories, I mean, she has this kind of just audacious way of writing where it's really in your face. Everything is exaggerated. And she says that sometimes, I think this is a Flannery O'Connor quote, she says, to the hard of hearing, you must shout. So her writing is a lot of shouting. And I think that's kind of what this book is doing. It's a Flannery O'Connor kind of book. This is God taking all of these various narratives and shouting at Israel and shouting at us as well, as to indicate that this is what happens when people do what is right in their own eyes, that humanity cannot be trusted to kind of decide what is right and wrong, what is good and bad, because when they do, inevitably, on an individual level or a family level or a national level, things are going to slip into more and more violence and self-serving behavior, and even into stories like we've covered in these last few chapters. And it also, as the counterpart to that, impresses upon us that there's only one hope, and there's only one way that humanity can be saved from itself, and that is from the Lord, who so often is ignored or rejected in the book of Judges. He sends savior after savior to them, deliverer after deliverer to them. He's patient. He's merciful. He judges as well. But behind all of these dark stories is the light of his love that is going to be the only thing that's able to save the Israelites as well as all of us.
Yeah, I mean, this statement, in those days there was no king in Israel, includes God.
Absolutely. In fact, some people think that is what is meant. Yeah. Not that there was no human king, but there was
no king, period. God,
no king, period. Yeah, that God was not acknowledged as the king of Israel. And this is what happened. With that being said, in the book of Ruth, which we will start next week, we're going to hear a whole lot more about people who are devoted to Yahweh and some of their struggles, and how God is going to, in the midst of this very dark period, is going to bring about the light of hope in a marriage, as well as the conception of a boy who will end up from his line producing the greatest king Israel ever had.
That's right.
So, yeah, here we go.
All right, guys. Season. Well, if you're depressed, stay tuned. Don't bail out on us now. Things are going to get better. So next week is Ruth. Guys, if you would like to rate and review the podcast, that would help us out. Go do that on iTunes or wherever you listen to it. Makes us more visible. If you'd like to support the podcast and everything else that we do, you can go to 1517.org and go to the donate page. You can become a contributor. Chad, I will see you next week.
All right. We'll see you here.